out!
Al Pacino!
It's not Al anymore. It's Dunk.
Dunkachino?
Don't mind if I do.
What's my name?
Dunkachino!
On this week's episode of the Laser Blast Film Society, we'll be talking about the screening of retros in multiplexes, two classic animes, the work of Michael Mann, and finally, we're going to end up with a few recommendations and the big question, how important are likable characters in cinema? My name's Justin The Clue.
I'm Pierce Sturks.
And you're listening to the Laser Blast Film Society.
17-0, lining up for my Dunkachino. What's my name?
Dunkachino!
Dunkachino!
And today's first subject is something very dear to one of our hosts' heart. It's what he's been doing all week. What have you been doing all week, Pierce?
Well, funny you should ask that, Justin.
So off the cuff.
Yeah,
like we haven't practiced it.
No, I have been seeing a shit ton of movies this week.
Why have you been seeing so many movies, and where have you been seeing them?
I have been seeing most of them actually at a Cineplex, which is a little bit odd, because usually with the multiplexes, we typically don't see too many new releases. Like, when a new release comes out and it's something that interests us, of course we make our way to the theater to check it out. But most of
the
time...
On the cheap day.
Yeah, on the cheap day. But I, like, as anyone who's listening to the show knows that recently I've been trying to go back and, you know, check out older films that I've missed over the years and kind of give myself a kind of impromptu film history over the course of the year. And luckily enough for me, Cineplex this past week had something that they call the Great Digital Film Fest, where they showed a series of older films, some classics, some's more just like, hey, these might be fun for people to go and watch. And so I was able to check out 5 screenings of that.
And how have the screenings been? Like, you've been someone that we've spoken before about how, you know, the multiplex experience is not something that has evolved too well when it comes to newer movies. And does that translate to, like, retros when they play them? Do people show the proper amount of respect, or are they just assholes like
it,
they are
most of the time? It depends on... It's the same as going to see any movie. It just honestly depends on the people that are going there. I found a lot of times the people that are kind of there early and are just like eagerly anticipating seeing the movie, it's one thing. But also with these retros, because of the cheaper ticket prices, you get a lot of people going in saying just like, oh, it's not that much more than a rental. So they just go and check it out. And so you get people coming in and they're treating it because it's an older movie and they assume everyone has seen it and just like they know the movie, that it's okay to kind of talk to it and treat it as like a living room experience.
And you don't like that. You'd rather people sit silently and
no,
just watch
it's,
the movie.
No
quote alongs for you.
It's... Well, the thing is, like, if you have a quote-along...
Put it
know,
in the title.
...screening, yeah, that's one thing, but it's not even so much, like, quoting along. It's just, like, being like, hey, what's happening? Who's this character? What's happening?
Did that happen while you're watching any movies? Because you saw Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Here's all the movies that I saw in order of which I saw them. Or do you want to save for a later conversation?
Maybe a later conversation. We could talk about it. What I really wanted to bring up is that an interesting movie-going experience you had is that you saw Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. No.
Excellent Adventure. Yes.
Not it the was... superior second film, but the first movie.
I don't know, because I had never seen any of the Bill and Ted
And you
films.
Had an interesting experience with that film, didn't you?
Yeah, it was like a 5:30 screening on a Monday night. So it's not prime, cinema-goer slot. But still, I went in there. There are about 30 people there, and then it's on a massive screen. It's on one of the biggest cinemas in there. If any of you are familiar with Scotiabank, a Cineplex downtown Toronto, it's got... I think it was like Cinema 4 or whatever. Mm. So it's one of those like big screens that you usually save for kind of the big new releases. But I went in there and see, you know, Bill and Ted's.
Yes.
Excellent
classic,
adventure.
As many people would argue.
Yeah, there are about 30 people in there. It wasn't too big, but like the screening starts. It's a beautiful, gorgeous, like digital remastered version for its 25th anniversary. But the thing is that it really kind of brought up a question in my mind of like how well some of these movies, when people are seeing them for the first time, like how well does the humor age?
You sort of these kind of big questions of like, how is something in the 80s still funny?
Yeah, because so much of it is just like, you know, guys going like, dude, and like doing electric guitar shtick. And it's
that's not funny. Are you trying to say that people don't enjoy Wayne's World anymore, which is basically the Bill and Ted's minus the time travel?
Yeah. I don't know, because I haven't, it's been so long since I've seen Wayne's World. But yeah, I was in there with, you know, about 30 or so people, and there were people in there that were fans of the movie. But the thing is, no one really laughed.
It just played to dead silence.
It wasn't complete dead silence. Like, there would be chuckles from time to time. And, like, you would look and you see people having, like, little smiles on their faces.
But not a film. That was not a good environment for your first experience of the film.
Because it was a comedy, I was hoping, like, I would go to the theater and, like, other people, like, their laughter would be infectious, because I think that's...
Are you trying to say that you can't laugh by your own and you need
other people? No, I can, but I'm saying that it's much easier for me to laugh when other people are laughing. If I don't think something's funny, I'm still not going to laugh regardless how many people are laughing. But, you know, it's something that I'm on the edge about. It's usually some laughter will help. But that was a thing that really shocked me, is that people are just like, huh.
No one laughed.
Yeah, it... There were a few chuckles, but that was about it.
Do you think that showing these retros in these multiplexes that, you know, obviously dominate the filmmaking scene is something that's killing the independent cinema? Because, like...
I don't think it's necessarily killing the independent cinema, just based upon the fact that a lot of the stuff that these megaplexes are showing in their retrospectives, they're not typically what the art house crowd is chasing after.
It was like I said, Lock, Stock, Snatch, probably The Matrix, Groundhog Day. Classics. They play classics. Like, they're not trying to challenge anyone.
No, they're showing movies that people like want to see. They're fan favorites, so to speak. They're fan favorites. They're not necessarily like, yes, some of those do fall into the kind of independent cinemas retro screenings. But at the same time, those cinemas, like, they try to reach out for 35mm. But this has been going on for a couple of years, and the whole reason they started it is because going to see those movies, you know, depended on the quality of the print, it depended on the quality of all this stuff. So this is when studios were first releasing, like, 2K 2K digital prints of some of their older titles. And so they got them all, and they started showing them. And it turned out really well because a ton of people showed up. So I do think that the experience of going to see something and... like a Cineplex retrospective is a lot different than going to see it at an independent theater or an art house type situation.
It's interesting because I wonder if the theaters will ever stop or step out of that safety zone of just showing movies that people have already seen and want to see on the big screen, and maybe start challenging people to see other movies that they haven't seen, like doing classic series and stuff like that of films that may not be popular, and then it'll probably start challenging those independent cinemas.
But that's the thing that's happened, just because of the fact that we mentioned in a previous podcast, since Cineplex bought up the AMC 24, they've got so many screens to program downtown, so they're actually being
a little adventurous.
In my opinion, a little bit more adventurous than some of the independent cinemas. Mm-hmm. They're showing. They had a really interesting concept that I'm kind of disappointed that they dropped, but they were showing original films as double bills with remakes, because they did like the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo followed by like Fincher's version. They did the same thing with the Departed. Like, so they had some really interesting double bills. They also have played some much smaller films too that aren't really fan favorites, so to speak. Like, they showed like Tulane Blacktop. That was one of those.
Well, that has its cult, but it definitely is not like The Matrix. Like, people are going to come out for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a mix between these Hollywood films at the same time these films that do have a bit of a cult classic, you know, appeal to them. But at the same time, I still think they're doing a lot more, actually, than some of the independent cinemas are doing.
Well, I don't think anyone would argue that Toronto, at least at this point in time, is not a cinema that's thriving with retros. And I don't think it has been for a long time, probably since the Ballora was around. But even then, they didn't really focus on that thing, because I'm not someone who can do these kind of financial calculations, but I assume that it's just probably not making that much money. I think that the issue with these kind of cinemas, and I'm not an expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that it's something that, you know, cinemas that are more successful in this kind of thing, like, you can just look at L.A., like the CineFamily. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they brand. And the idea is getting people into the cinema. You have to make them believe that what they're coming to see is going to be good, even if they don't know what the movie is.
Yeah, and that's slightly the problem with these Cineplex screenings, because most of the time they are showing them at random, you know, nights and days and weekends. They don't really advertise. You have to go to the theater and see it just on a poster and be like, oh, this is coming up this month. This is what's showing. That's what's showing. But yeah, it's not really, there's no theme to it. So it's just like, we're showing random movies. Just like, we're just showing these because the hell of it. But I do wish more theaters in Toronto would have, like, here's like an essential cinema day. Like, we're showing like a classic film. Like, here's like a crazy cult like day, like a program where we show these type of films.
So you're basically saying that you'd rather these cinemas be curated in a way that is advertised to people in a way that almost feels like a community, and that you know that these things are happening. I think that's probably something that I miss from, cinemas in Toronto.
Because that's what's missing. You summed up exactly is the curation part of it. Mm-hmm. It's just like no one is being the DJ mm-hmm. of sorts when it comes to like choosing the films and choosing films that go well together. They're just like, hey, it's Halloween. Let's show some horror movies.
Yeah, people like these movies.
Yeah, it's just like people like these movies. We've got something to play. Let's just show them. Like, there's no real programming that's mm-hmm. going into it and being like, here's what's relevant. Here's what's topical. Like, here's what's doing this. Like, getting these films to work in a way that'll make people go see them, even if they're films that they're not aware of.
Mm-hmm. Or like you were saying, that if you're curating something and you want people to see something, you pick something that they like and curate it with something that maybe they don't know as well. It's kind of like that entryway.
A-side and B-sides. Yeah, like, exactly. It's the most simplistic thing you can possibly think
of. Put it
of.
On a double bill and they have to pay for it, and it's not that expensive, and maybe they'll enjoy both of them and they'll take a chance next time to go to the cinema.
Yeah, like, have it, you know.
I don't know how this turned into, like, how to run a theater, even though me and you have no idea.
No, we are discussing, these mm-hmm. These retrospectives, and I think that's a big thing, especially with retrospectives as well. Is to get an incentive for people to go to see more movies, because the big thing is that, like, there were no ticket packs. You couldn't be like, yeah, I want to buy like 5 tickets and like you get a discount. It's just like you go to pay for the movie that you want to see, and that's it. I think they're missing a big opportunity to do these retrospectives, but sell them as like kind of like see as many movies as you can type thing, because that also creates a bit of a challenge for the viewer. It's something that they have like a goal to work for, instead of just being like, hey, a movie showing. Just like, see it if
that
you
we
want
haven't
to.
Advertised.
Yeah, or don't. Which sadly, a lot of theaters.
Which is kind of frustrating doing. Because I'm all for the little guy, and I think that probably the littler cinemas, if they were tried to chance this, the problem is they don't have like the funds to play these kind of movies, which Cineplex does have.
But I think that's why they should do something different, because we're talking about the big multiplexes. Mm-hmm. The big multiplexes have access to like all these Hollywood films. So I do personally think that the smaller independent cinemas should be doing the type of stuff that they're not showing. Like, these guys are already showing The Matrix. These guys are already showing, like, Batman. They're already showing these things. You don't need to try to do your superhero retrospective. You don't need to be trying to show these films. Go out of the way and show stuff that is a little bit off the beaten path. But like you said, it's important to have that kind of that curated feel to it, where someone would be like, hey, I like these movies that these guys are saying are good movies, and so I will probably like these movies as well. Mm-hmm. Because if you just show something out of the, off the cuff that no one has heard of, you're not going to get too many people to show up. But if it's something to be like, hey, if you guys like these type of movies, you'll like this. And once again, that's where the double bill comes in a perfect, it helps out a ton. But I wish more cinemas would be doing that.
I wish they'd. I don't think they've ever done that since I moved to Toronto, like a long time ago. I it sounds like it did exist before, and there were cinemas like that, and they just kind of died out. So maybe we're wrong, and that doesn't work at all.
It works for me personally.
Yeah, so you would go see that.
Well, that's kind of what we do at our Laser Blast screenings. Is we typically get a double bill of films that don't necessarily, like, on the page, they sometimes don't go together, or like certain directors. They're and we do in the podcast. We choose films that are kind of like bigger known from directors and smaller films and so on.
Yeah, you just go in and you try to pick something that people will know and go, ooh, I would like to see that. And then you sneak the other one after it. And it's like, oh, why won't I? Like, I'll stick around and see another one.
Perfect is music is the perfect analogy for it. You've got your opening acts and you got like your headliners. And the problem is that no one is like putting an opening act in for these headliners. They're just showing the headliners. And
even though when you do movies, you should switch it around. You always play your headliner first, and then you play the opening act.
Yeah, well, that's also, as I said, like the A side and the B side. Mm.
All right, well, hopefully someone is listening out there, and they'll be like, Justin Pierce, you guys know what you're talking about? We really don't. Please come program movies for us. Speaking of that, I actually did have a chance to join you for one film and another one that I watched at home, and we'll be talking about that right after this break. Right after So one of the movies that I actually had a chance to watch with you in theaters was Ghost in the Shell, classic anime. It actually came out a lot later than I thought it did. 1998? I thought it was 1995.
Was it?
And we also got a chance to watch. You watched in the big three.
Oh, yeah, it was 95. You're right. Sorry.
But I watched it at home with Akira. And the question that I had is, like, these are considered, like, the ultimate anime. Like, when you talk about anime, feature lengths at least, I think the Ghost in the Shell, and minus the Miyazaki films, like, those are in a league of their own. I think that Akira and Ghost in the Shell were a lot of the entryway animes for people that got into it. I remember watching on TV the commercials that would play where it's like, too extreme for the U.S., dude, on VHS. Akira, just send in one payment of $49.95 for your VHS. Oh,
yes. I remember that.
And do you think that those movies, like, still hold up? Like, I mean, I can be honest, and I can say that the first time I saw Ghost in the Shell, I didn't like it that much. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people probably had the same opinion, because the director, Oshii, he doesn't seem to be very interested in creating a standard action movie or anime movie, which Akira would fall into.
Akira, though, I don't think it falls underneath the typical. It has a little bit more of a traditional plot structure in terms of escalation that goes throughout the film and so forth. But I don't think either of those are, you know, formulaic in any sense of the word, which is, I think, is why they are talked about so much.
Well, I think that structurally, Akira does hit all the beats that it needs to.
Yes.
And I think that even at a film at 2 hours and 4 minutes, it flies by.
Oh, it flies by so fast.
Well, it's a blockbuster. That's what Akira is. And I mean, it may be dealing with, like, more weighty themes, but even when it was being made, like, I remember reading somewhere that with inflation, it cost like $20 million. And it did, well, like, a whole bunch of stuff that had never been done before in anime.
It shows, because, you know, what is it, over 25 years now? When did that
I believe it came out in 1988 or 87.
88, yes, 88. So, and just, like, viewing this on the big screen, it was amazing because, as I said before, you know, sometimes at these screenings people talk, but this was pretty much like a sold-out screening. The entire cinema was packed. And Akira has a lot of quiet moments into it. It has a lot of where they successfully pull the audio out, you know, for effect, and it's very dramatic. But this is one of the first times I've been in a cinema, and you know, I've been watching those type of films where I don't hear someone like chewing popcorn or someone like...
Oh, so people were completely enraptured in the movie.
They were completely...
But I'll probably argue that the people that were seeing that movie had seen it before.
There were a lot of people that were seeing that for the first time, because it was a lot of just like, oh man, you've never seen Akira?
Oh, you heard that?
Yeah, I heard that so much. Like, there are so many first dates or just like people bringing friends. Just like,
I don't think Akira would be a very good first date movie.
Yeah, there's one scene in particular that some people are like, But yeah, it's just amazing, you know, that a film that still looks that fantastic.
Well, it hasn't aged today. I think that cell animation and the fact that it takes place like in the near future, and it doesn't have that many quirks that a lot of even something like Ninja Scroll has those, which is another entry feature length film into anime. And when I say like entry feature length film, I'm talking about the most stereotypical examples of when you think of it, like violence. Usually futuristic kind of thing, action movies.
Something philosophical.
Yeah, there's some philosophical. I don't think Ninja Scroll has much philosophical stuff in
it. But yeah, no, you're right. I didn't really think about that. But all things considered, Akira doesn't have too many of the anime tropes that you fall into, like the weird sort of character expressions or kind of the offbeat humor. It all translates very, very fluidly.
And I was even thinking on a more technical standpoint that it has a very high frame rate, and it doesn't have the pauses that you usually associate, or the recycled backgrounds or stuff like that, or the introspective moments that are just like, we're just going to save a little bit and pad out the running time, which, you know, you accept with a lot of TV shows. And that is something. I mean, we grew up on stuff like Dragon Ball Z, where that was part and parcel, where you accepted that, like, that some of the, like, especially anime TV shows have a start and stop structure because they have so many things, and a lot of the movies work that way too.
Yeah, and just like a lot of animes too, you get the thing like, oh, it's a close-up, we're just going to use this one cell of animation and just like slowly zoom the camera in.
I mean, Akira is a movie that's a little bit tough to talk at length about because it is good. And I mean, our friend Christian Murdoch was here a few moments ago and decided to leave because he doesn't like Akira very much.
See, I wish he stayed to, you know,
but he says he doesn't like anime in general, which is a weird generalization.
But, yeah, but that's the thing, is that I would argue that you don't have to like anime to like Akira.
Well, you do. And I mean, I can understand, like, if my mom watched Akira, she'd be like, it's too violent. And I'm confused. But, you know, Christian falls into those, like, he likes the kind of stuff that we like. So I'm shocked that he doesn't like Akira. On the other hand, I can understand why he wouldn't like Ghost in the Shell, which...
Yes.
On the bus, when we were riding the subway, he said... Where it's a robot that can be anyone. Why does it have to be a robot who's always naked and has giant boobs?
Yeah, Ghost in the Shell does feel a little bit more anime.
You think that it's like hitting those like anime tropes?
I think it's hitting a little bit of them, but it still is a very fascinating film. One thing we should point out, though, is that the screening that we went to, on the marquee, it was billed as just Ghost in the Shell. And
but
like,
we had Ghost in the Shell, the shitty version.
2.0.
Oh, is it called 2.0?
It's called Ghost in the Shell 2.0.
I thought Ghost in the Shell 2 is 2.0, Innocence.
No, it's just called Ghost in the Shell 2.0.
Which is probably one of the most baffling decisions ever. When did it come out?
2008.
Okay, and it looked like it came out in 1997 of all
yes,
the new
Yes, it looked
CG.
Like it came out like 3 years later. Here's the most baffling thing. They take some of the most iconic scenes from Ghost in the Shell, and they replace them with computer graphic animation that looks like it's straight from a PlayStation 1 cutscene. Like, it just looks so bloody terrible. I was actually just, for the first couple of minutes, I'm just like, I don't want to watch this movie.
Well, I actually said, I turned to Peter, I went, ugh, bullshit. And you went, shh. No talking. Like, did you know what I was talking about?
I did, but it was because, like, if you started doing it, I was going to be like, oh my god, this looks like ass. Because I was going to fall into
I almost
that
did
trap.
A spit take because I thought the whole film would be animated that way. But thank God.
I had not seen it. Like, it was something that I was vaguely aware of that I heard of once, but I'm pretty sure it was immediately followed by never watch this version of the film. So I'm a bit baffled. That's why they
it's probably
the
it's the newest version, so that's like the DCP
yeah,
they can
or,
get.
Yeah,
that's
or
probably
that's something
exactly
that the distributor
why.
Showed them.
But forgetting that, let's never speak of that again. And if you want to watch Ghost in the Shell, make sure you see the original version.
Yes, because the version from 95 looks 100 times better
and
than
you
the
can get
from
like Blu-ray versions of it, like
yeah,
like pristine.
And I'm pretty sure the Blu-ray version of it comes with the original version. It may be one of those bullshit things where you click on it and it goes automatically to the quote unquote director's cut of it, but just bypass it. Ugh. This is easily one of the worst director cuts that I've seen in terms of the addition, because the additions added nothing. They just changed the animation. It didn't affect the story. It didn't affect any of that. It just.
So like a lot of Oshii's film, Ghost in the Shell is interesting because it drops you media res, you know, right into the action without
yes.
explaining very much. And I looked on it online just to make sure, and it is based on a manga, so you don't need those introductory parts, but you really have to play catch up with the film, and it has all the pieces of the genre you'd expect, but doesn't really do what you expect to do with them.
No, and to me that's one of the positive elements of Ghost in the Shell is the fact that you take this, you know, kind of futuristic cyber thriller aspects of it, but at the same time it builds up the momentum, it goes really fast, then it slows everything down, it goes into like these more quiet character driven moments and these strange like detective moments. It's got some nice, you know, interaction between the two leads, but it is a film that has a very weird structure to it. The flow of it is very start and stop.
Well, it's pretty much start, stop, start, the movie's over.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
What it
that
is.
That is it. But yeah, no. Let's talk about like what are some things that you like about Ghost in the Shell? For you, did it still hold up going back and watching it? You know,
I think I enjoyed it more this time because I expected, you know, going in what it was going to be. Like, I have a little bit more experience with Oshii's films, and me and someone who can't be here today, Peter Kaplowski, who we saw Ghost in the Shell with, and when we left the theater, he was like, are we recording a podcast now? I was making mental notes to talk about.
No, I don't think he knows that we don't have the portable recorder anymore. So
no, sadly we yeah. do not. And he introduced we talked about Oshii's films a lot, and you know, Oshii has kind of, I don't know if you call it regressing or evolving as he's gone along, and gone even more into the style of like stop, like just like discuss.
Yeah, well, what are some of his other films for people who aren't familiar
with? Pat Labor is a perfect example, which is, if you look at the box, you think it's going to be about a TV show about fighting robots like Gundam Wing, and it's anything but. It's basically the movie of, I feel like Oshii likes to make movies that are between the moments of those blockbusters like Akira. And that's what Ghost in the Shell feels. Even like the action of Ghost in the Shell, when it does show up, is kinetic, but it's not exactly what you would expect it to be. For example, the one big set piece at the beginning of the movie, you don't even see the main character and that she's invisible. So it's like twisting what you would expect and doing it in a different way. Or even at the end, a little spoilery, someone gets incredibly injured by trying to do a simple action.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why those sequences, they pop out so much, is because of the fact that while he has a distinct rhythm, it's not the rhythm that you're used to. Mm-hmm. He's hitting notes that are great, but they're not the ones that you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got this wonderful, you know, freeform quality to it that's that feels a little bit experimental, a little bit improvisational, as if you compare it to something too like Akira. While even though the themes of that film are so far out there, but it's still hitting, like you said, those action movie. It's still, you know, building that crescendo.
I'm curious to see why this one, Ghost in the Shell, and while I really like it, like, it did become a hit, and it did become that, like, entryway into anime for a lot of people, and why that particular film versus other ones.
I think the big thing with those two films are the whole cyberpunk aspect.
I looked at Johnny Mnemonic came out the same year as Ghost in the Shell, which I would have put Johnny Mnemonic a few years later. But at the same time, I mean, William Gibson wrote Johnny Mnemonic, and he is basically the father of cyberpunk when he wrote Neuromancer.
And of course, also, that I think a lot of people, their introduction to The Matrix, and they looked at what films inspired the Wachowskis. Those are films that they look back, and of course Ghost in the Shell was one of those.
But so even Ghost in the Shell, like, it feels like it could have easily come after The Matrix, because it's commenting on all these things in a postmodern way, while The Matrix is, like, absorbing them and expressing them literally.
Well, I think you have to group these films, including Akira, with like Blade Runner. They're films that I think that, as time has gone by, people have discovered them more based upon what they have to say about technology and, just the future. It's one of these weird cases where, just like, Ghost in the Shell is still just as relevant today as it was back in 95. It doesn't feel like it's aged in a bit. Same with Akira. Like, the themes are still just as relevant today. And that is something that I honestly wasn't expecting to happen when I chose to revisit these films this past week.
Mm-hmm. That they still held up in the way you thought that you would have to approach them, as like nostalgic items and be
That's the thing, is for a lot of these, especially tying back in with these retros, is that a lot of those films you do go for the nostalgic factor, i.e. Bill and Ted. Mm. It's not something you could be like, oh, this is like a
genuinely hilarious comedy classic. Like, it's amusing.
Yeah, it's something that you go for just the nostalgia factor. But the thing with Ghost in the Shell and Akira is the fact that they still felt so fresh and they still felt so innovative, which is very impressive considering how much stuff has been influenced by them or like ripped them off wholesale or just, taken bits and pieces from there. It's still very impressive, the fact that these films hold up the way that they do.
Well, I don't think there's any argument between both of us that these films are two classics, which, segues back into our big question of how important is it for movies to have likable characters?
I'm badass. And you're good, Ash. You're a goody little two-shoes. You're a goody little two-shoes. Goody little two-shoes. Little goody 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 two-shoes.
Good, bad. I'm the guy with the gun.
Well, we've gone on this long without getting to our big question of the week. How important is it for films to have likable characters? And this is one that I think a lot of people will have very easy answers to. As Peter Kaplowski said, it doesn't matter. What do you think, Pierce? Do you think it's important? And I think the way we can approach this is, how important is it for people to like the movies? Because I was talking with a friend recently, and I was saying that usually when people recommend a film and it's universally recommended, there will be likable characters in that movie, and it will have some kind of a satisfying ending. Because movies can be good that don't, but to puncture that mass appeal, it needs to hit certain beats, and likable characters is one that's very important. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to say that in order for a film to have mass appeal, it does absolutely need a likable protagonist. And I'm not talking about films that are considered like classics, because that's a whole other thing. But for a film, for the whole office water cooler, that type thing, be like, oh, you see this movie, like, oh yeah, it was great, it was great, like that type of situation where just like everyone can just go and like see and love a movie. Then yes, I do think that likable protagonists are a must. There are, of course, classics and films that are just like really huge, and some that even do have a bit of mainstream crossover where they do have unlikable protagonists, where they do have anti-heroes. But at the same time, I do think that it's very important for a film to have that major success, so to speak, that you do kind of need the audience to sympathize with your main character.
You brought up an interesting, you know, characteristic I was going to talk about, which is the anti-hero. Mm-hmm. And that term gets thrown around a lot as like, you know, this character's an anti-hero. And, you know, based on just the phrasing of the word, you would assume that this guy is basically a villain. But anti-hero in like our, you know, modern definition just means a badass. That's a hero.
To me, it doesn't mean just a badass. To me, it means a hero that has a very large gray area to their character where it's just like they're not typical. Because when the typical definition of a hero is someone who's just like pure and righteous, is, you know, like there to save the day, is just, you know, your Luke Skywalker type character, that type of.
Your Han Solo would be your anti-hero then.
Yeah, exactly. It's more, well, he was before, you know, they changed the
Return of the Jedi.
Well, no, I was going to bitch about the Lucas
shooting
cut.
First.
Yeah.
No, leave that alone.
I know, but no, yeah, that's a very good way to kind of just the simplest way to, I think, to describe that is what we just did is like. Your kind of most basic standard definition, hero, Luke Skywalker, anti-hero, Han Solo.
Mm.
But yeah, anti-hero can be much more than that. You can have definitely your main characters of a film just be, you know, abhorrent characters.
And you would call them anti-heroes as long as they push the narrative?
As long as they push the narrative and they're the ones that are, you know, they're the driving force of the film. They're the ones that are, you know, moving the plot forward. They're the ones that are... that are causing the change necessary in order for, you know, the sequences to progress, I would call them anti-heroes.
So someone like Robert De Niro, Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, he's the anti-hero. But that you could argue that film was a classic and it's, you know, universally known. But I wouldn't say it was universally popular.
No, it wasn't. It's one of the, because of the fact that I believe that it is hard for some... audiences to digest the fact that, you know, just like, oh, like, am I supposed to be rooting for this guy? That's the question I think pops up. Should you be rooting for him?
That's a universal question. And I think a lot of people have difficulty grappling with this. And it, you know, feeds into the, is the character likable? Because a lot of movies, like, I was thinking about one, I don't remember which one we were talking about recently, where you watch it and people didn't like it because they thought you had to be rooting for that character.
Was it Spring Breakers that we were discussing?
Yes, it was Spring Breakers. And in Spring Breakers, like, if you think that these characters are doing things that are right... And I guess blockbuster movies follow such an easy formula that you know that what they're doing is right because these are your protagonists. Why would you be focusing on them?
Well, you have a hero. The hero has an obstacle. The hero has to overcome said obstacle and then usually goes on to save the day by overcoming their own personal obstacles along with the ones that are thrown at them. That's just storytelling 101. That's the basic of it. But I do believe that's why there is such issue when these films come up. A big polarizing one for people recently... and a film that I love is Only God Forgives.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk about having a likable character.
Well, there's no likable characters.
There are
only
no likable characters in that film whatsoever, which is especially hard for people coming into After Drive, where it's just like a lot of the charm of that film was based upon Ryan Gosling's, you know, character. The fact that even though on the page he seems like a little bit anti-hero, he was still more of the typical hero of those films, of that franchise. So, yeah, Only God Forgives, I think, that ties perfectly into this discussion because of the fact that everyone is so terrible. You can't root for anything that they're doing. You can't agree with any of their choices. But my big argument is I'm going to say it doesn't matter if a character is likable as long as that character is interesting, as long as that character is captivating, as long as that character is doing something where you're wondering what they're going to do next. I don't think it matters at all if the character is likable. It will hurt the film's success. There's no doubt about it. But I don't think it particularly is a deciding factor for me if the character is likable.
Yeah, I don't think that anyone who considers them like a general movie fan can sit there and say, yes, every movie that I watch has to have likable characters. Because, you know, that'd be limiting so many stories that you can tell. And because fiction or nonfiction or anything like that, it's important that you are invested in what's going on. And whether they're doing something that you believe in or not, you want to see what happens next.
That's the thing. Like, you can have a cast of great characters and a terrible story, but you can still have a great story that's filled with very unlikable characters, or, you know, just characters that you would not typically root for. And I think there is some struggle for people to, you know, define those and be comfortable with those boundaries.
You have to be defining your own rules when you're watching the film. And I think that a lot of people that approach cinema is just, you know, I want to be entertained for an hour and a half to 2 hours. They have difficulty having to, you know, rewrite what they're watching.
Well, it just creates an uncomfortable moral dilemma in some aspects, because it's kind of like that age old thing. It's just like, you know, a guy robs a bank to steal, like, you know, like $500,000. Is he a bad man because he stole the money? So the audience, like, is against him because, like, oh, he did something that's wrong.
But if
it's revealed that he has to, you know, use that money to save, like, his dying daughter or whatever, then the audience begins to sympathize with him. And so it creates this big, you know, moral gray area. And that's at the point where audiences start to feel a little bit uncomfortable, because then they have to start questioning their own morals and, like, their own ideas, and just, like, it basically, like, not everything's black and white, and that's an area where it starts to bleed together. That's where it gets to be a problem.
But even in that example, like, I think that there's, like, in the audience perception, what is a greater good? Mm-hmm. Versus, like, money versus, and it depends on every person. But at the same time, like, I've written reviews where I've gone, like, this movie doesn't work because this character is not likable. But there's a very specific reason, is that some of these films, the creators don't realize their characters are unlikable, and they're trying to make them likable because they have to be anchor. And you know what example I'm going to use, because we were talking about it on the Laser Blast Facebook group.
I don't even remember.
Spider-Man. The amazing Spider-Man.
Yes.
Came up because we can talk about the first film, but also the second film trailer, which is that, you know, Peter Parker's an interesting character in that he is supposed to be, as his, you know, human identity, very quiet and shy and kind of inward. But as Spider-Man, he is a big, boisterous presence. And he's been famous for his strategy when fighting villains is just talking the entire time to, you know, try to distract
them. Talking smack, being a smart aleck, mm-hmm. being a little bit of a jackass.
But and Sam Raimi approached that problem pretty much by ignoring that facet of the character. Like, he didn't get into it. So when Mark Webb was directing The Amazing Spider-Man, the reboot that just happened recently, he was like, well, I'm going to have the funny Spider-Man. Like, we're going to go back to the roots, like Stan Lee and stuff like that. And what we end up with is Andrew Garfield giving a performance of a fucking douche. Like,
yeah, I'm going to argue, though, that I don't, like, it's, I feel bad for Andrew Garfield, because I do think that he's trying with this role. But once again, it's not that he as an actor is unlikable. It's his character that is just, you know.
And I think that it's that disconnect of the creators don't know that this is unlikable. Like, they probably watch it like, oh, look, he's charming. Like,
yeah, but it is. When you have characters like that, it falls underneath the ground where you have two extreme personality types. It does fall into, like, some people find it likable, while other people's, it can be very off-putting. And a lot of times, you know, those swarmy, just kind of like smart aleck characters, they do, they try to balance a line of being likable and being obnoxious. It's the same with, think of any comedic relief character from a film, mm-hmm. where it's just like, am I supposed to laugh at this character, or do I just want to, like, bash his brains in because he won't shut the hell up?
That may come down to the actor a lot, too, and how charismatic an actor being can pull it off. Like, you know, we talked about Philip Seymour Hoffman last week, and he was, you know, he made it a career of playing unlikable characters, but making them charismatic in a way that you want to see more of them and that you find them interesting on screen. Well, if we go back to Spider-Man, he's saying all this smart stuff that, you know, that just makes him look like a douche.
Yeah, but also the big problem that it falls in there is that I think those scripts and those films, they're focused around the idea of having a likable character, because, like, hey, he's Spider-Man. Everyone loves
Spider-Man.
Everyone loves fucking Spider-Man. It's like, you gotta love him. But the problem is that the scripts and the stories, they're centered around of the audience caring about what happens to Spider-Man and caring about if he's able to succeed and caring about, like any type of film where, like, the hero's journey, so to speak, or the hero has to do all these
quests.
Do you
think you need a likable character in that situation?
I think you do need a likable character, because in those situations where you're not more interested to see, like, how the greater scheme plays together as a whole, but when you're following one character on his journey, because let's go back to Taxi Driver. Taxi Driver is not really just like, oh, I wonder what's going to happen to Travis Bickle next. Is he going to get out of this sticky situation? Like, it's not that. It's more just like, oh my God, what the hell is this guy going to do next? And that is far different than being just like, oh, our character is in danger. He's in peril. I don't care. Just let him die. And that is the big problem that you have with these
you're sitting there with your arms crossed watching Spider-Man being like, I just wish he would die.
Yeah, and that's the problem is that when you have those films that are structured around being like rooting for your character, where you have to root for the character in order for the film to have, you know, to have the thrills, to have the humor and have the romance. And yeah, like romance is another big thing. Like you have to have likable people for a romance to work.
Unless you're watching you're approaching the romantic situation more analytically. And you're looking at like people like breaking up or something like that and watching why it breaks up.
But once again, I think that that falls into a completely different type of film. I'm talking about for your...
Like a rom-com?
That your standard, your rom-com and like, you know, action movie that's supposed to have a romantic subplot. You have to have those people be likable because if a character... This is a big thing that you see a lot in scripts. It's okay for the character not to be the most well-fleshed out individual. Just like get someone who's charming to play them. They can solve the problems that we have in the script. We can just, you know, we can smooth that out by having someone that's universally likable or is a nice performance that they can give.
That never happens.
No, it doesn't, which I don't understand.
Unless you're Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Yeah, but even then I would say that his characters are still kind of...
Well, he plays himself. I think that the argument is that when you have someone charismatic, the innate likability in them will come through.
Like Harrison Ford.
He plays Harrison Ford.
He made a giant career out of playing Harrison Ford. Although, you can argue that once again, Blade Runner, not a likable character.
No, he's definitely not a likable character. And I've argued before that Decker is a completely incompetent character in Blade Runner and that he doesn't really achieve things. Just like Jack Nicholson's character in Chinatown, that movie's like many people consider that a classic, but that character, people seem to forget that he gets everything wrong in that movie.
Film noirs usually have...
Perfect, yeah.
Film noir is usually the main character, often is a schmuck. It's just, you know, a guy that just like kind of gets entangled in this situation and he sees how it plays out. And if he's smart enough, he can make it out at the end and be like the one that succeeds from it. But most of the time he's just on for the ride. He's not the one that's moving things. He's just trying to keep up and usually, you know, gets his ass kicked at doing so. But
do people keep going towards that, you think, though? Especially film noir, the genre that has its like fanatical devotees. I can't say that word. and especially, you know, I love film noir. You love film noir too?
I love film noir to death. But I think it comes back to what I just mentioned earlier is because of the fact that those stories, you want to see how it all ties together. Mm-hmm. They're not usually rooted around being like, I want this character to win. Like, I want this detective.
So you're just like, I want to see how it turns out. Like, I want to see how will they murder the husband. You know, how will these things, but like, you know, film noirs can still have likable characters, but usually they're rooted in a deep cynicism in that, like, if you try something, you will fail. I mean, you know, going from film noir to something that, you know, the directors kind of treat it like that, like the Coen brothers, their films are usually not rooted in likable characters. And people have argued that the Coen brothers are filmmakers that if you have a distaste from them, it's because they're laughing at their characters. I mean, you can still say that there's some love for them in some movies, like Raising Arizona. They're kind of goofballs, but
it's a combination. I find that the Coens are more laughing with their characters than just pointing and being like, oh, these guys suck. Because most of the time when you do have humor like that or characterizations like that, it often comes across as very, very crass, very sometimes even racist in some regards. And it's just, I don't think you have that problem with the Coens. I feel that they're embracing the eccentricities.
Yeah, I can't like say they're not today. They're not making fun of them. I mean, it depends on how you want to approach the film, because the characters, you just got to look like at Inside Llewyn Davis. Like, that is a character that's not really that likable.
No,
and he's punished
not
throughout. But I don't think the film is asking you, and that's an interesting, because you are interested in what's going to happen in that character, and you do want to see, even though he's not that likable, because at the end of the day it comes down that he's human.
Yes.
And there's a big difference between like someone like Henry Portrait of the Serial Killer, which is doing something different, to Inside Llewyn Davis, where you're looking at a human character in all his complexities and what's going to happen. And it's funny because Inside Llewyn Davis did not get nominated for an Oscar this year.
Yeah, I don't know why, but going back to another Coen's film, Fargo, like that is not particularly filled with likable character.
It does have a likable lead.
The lead, but at the same time, she's not thrown to the mix to like half an hour into the film. And it's still, it can be argued that they're making fun of those people. They're making fun of like
the
their
William
way of
H. Macy character, Steve Buscemi, Peter Stormare. But I think that film is, what you're doing there is that you're capturing types.
Yeah.
And that in you're illustrating those types, like sketching them in and then putting them in situations to see how they get out of it. I don't think they could have sustained a whole film by their own. And I think that the ensemble cast for especially Fargo, that's what makes it work.
I would argue that I would just watch a film with Steve Buscemi and that guy just riding around in a car.
I think it would get pretty old probably pretty fast.
I wanted to see what was going to happen to them.
There's a Fargo TV show coming out, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I did hear about that, yeah.
I don't know how they're going to sustain. And a Rosemary Baby TV show. Like, that's weird. Like,
that makes absolutely no sense.
Like, Rosemary's Baby is a film for the longest time I didn't want to see because I'm like, well, I know how it ends. Yeah. Like, and, you know, it's a good movie, but yeah, it ends the way that you think it's going to end. Yeah. But going back, you know, speaking of that, it made me think of slasher films, which are not, and you know,
oh yeah, it's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah, because what you're asking, and I think personally, and I've written slasher films before, none of them have been produced. If you'd like to give me money, I'd be happy to accept it. But I have always said that slasher films make the most impact if you have likable characters that are getting killed, because then you care about what happened and you get invested. But at the same time, probably the most popular film franchise, Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, Halloween, have made a stock and trade of making unlikable characters to see killed.
But I would argue that they still have a likable lead.
In the slasher film character?
Because, like, Nightmare on Elm Street, Nancy, she is a...
But that's the first one. That's different. Like,
that's,
once you...
But that's the reason why they became popular, I believe, that they became... They achieved a certain, wide level of success is because of the fact that they did have likable protagonists.
Who's a likable protagonist in Friday the 13th that's not Kevin Bacon? The girl that gets chased at the end? I don't even remember her name.
I don't like Friday the 13th Part 1. I don't remember anything
so
about that film.
That's a bad example.
I don't remember anything about that film. But no, it was more of, I was referring to like Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween. Like,
yeah.
They do have
they do have successful leads at the end. Yeah. But then what they mutate in, are you going to take the Gene Siskel route and be morally reprehensible? Because you like slasher films.
I like slasher films, but I do, once again, it's more for the inventiveness of it to see like how they're going to, you know, mix it up, you know, what the gag's going to be. It's basically, you're just, slasher films are like a joke. You're just waiting for the punchline. You just want to see how the punchline works. And I think slasher films, a lot of them, you could have a much more interesting setup. And I think that involves having characters that aren't just the same douchey teens over and over and over and over again. And I think a big problem is that because we keep revisiting these classic slashers, we've seen the douchey teens. I think everyone is just sick of them. Like, it's okay to have like a few obnoxious characters that you cheer to get killed off. But I think the big problem is that they're excluding suspense in terms of rooting for the killer, rooting just like, yeah, kill those guys. Like, I think you still do need some likable people that are tossed in there. But the biggest problem I have is that films where they do have these gigantic sequences that are centered around suspense, centered around fear, when you just don't give a shit about what's going to happen to anyone because they are so obnoxious and because they are so terrible.
That's a question I ask myself every time I write something, is that can you sustain something like, for example, the Paranormal Activity films, which could be argued are just the scares, and that the characters in those movies are very thinly sketched. And if you need someone that you can associate to and that you care what happens to them, or you can just have a blank slate and you're just wondering, like, will something happen? Will I be scared? And that you're the one that you project yourself into it. Because that's a whole other can of worms, is that if it's a blank slate, you can project yourself into it. Or is it someone likable that you care to see what happens?
See, I've never been able to do the blank slate and project yourself into them. I've always found it to be very lazy, and I find it to be very kind of mediocre filmmaking. It's just because of the fact that when you do have that blank slate, it's just like, I'm not throwing myself in these situations. Horror movies don't scare me because I'm thinking like, oh God, if I was in this situation, like, I don't want to be in like, you know, this dark forest. I don't want to be trapped in this room. I'm much more interested and seeing what's going to happen to these characters. I don't put myself into these situations. I think there are films where putting yourself into the situation works, but I think it's much more with films that, that discuss choices and discuss like life choices.
So more like philosophical questions.
Yeah, yeah, more philosophical. Even like stuff like a little bit like French New Wave, that type of thing, where it's more of like it's a conversation about people. It's a conversation about the choices that people make.
So what about action films? Like I would argue that like I watch a lot of Hong Kong films, and you're particular. You know, you're okay with them.
Yeah.
I think they. But I can watch action films that have no characterizations in them. And, I mean, you could argue that I'm looking at that film for different things, that I'm looking for stunts or choreography. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I do get involved in what's going on, even though that character is not something huge for me.
But are you getting involved because it's fun and because it's just like your
experience? Yeah, it's
experience?
Fun. The situation in itself is fun, which demands they're not having to be likable characters because what's going on is fun. But at the same time, I mean, I'm in the minority on that one. A lot of people just check out if they don't like what's going on. And it's the classic, you know, question is like, what does action need to be? Which should be another big question of like, does it need to be further the story, or can there be action for action's sake when you watch a movie?
Yeah, as we've discovered, this is a big can of worms
that we opened.
We're digging into. But you know what? I'm going to say that it really does depend
on the movie.
On your movie, on your script, on the story that you're trying to tell. And I think all those factors, you know, determine whether if your movie can succeed without a likable protagonist, without likable characters.
I agree with you, and I think that it's really important that depending on the story you tell, you have to make sure that if you want the audience to like your character, to make him goddamn likable, and not just assume that you're going to be able to coast on it.
Yeah, just don't, you know, factor in like, oh, it's going to be a pretty face, it's going to be a character that people know, and stick with that. Actually make sure that they are well-rounded characters and interesting.
Which brings us to the high and low movies that we're going to talk about, which are Heat and Manhunter.
In the Garden of Eden, honey, don't you know that I love you? In the Garden of Eden,
I have a feeling that a lot of our high and low screenings are probably just going to be based on whatever film I've recently watched that week. And
yeah,
then I'm
you're the bastard that's choosing all these. I haven't been able to choose a single one of these. You're just like, let's watch this. At least last week I got off watching Pretty Woman, you son of a bitch.
Hey, well, I had to suffer through Pretty Woman.
You chose that.
You kind of picked Viva La Vie, because I kind of accompanied you to that one.
Hey, you asked me first, like, hey, are you checking out Viva La Vie?
Oh, you liked it, so, you know, you didn't lose that much out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I ended up watching Manhunter, the Michael Mann film, which, what year was it made?
1986.
Was it Michael Mann's first film?
No, it was not his first film. I think it was around his third. He originally had, like, a TV movie.
Mm-hmm.
He did Thief. And then he did like
that's right.
Film.
Thief is his first theatrical film.
Yes.
And Manhunter being the adaptation of the Thomas Harris novel Red Dragon.
Yes.
Was later made by Brett Ratner as Red Dragon.
Well, a thing that a lot of people forget is this is the first time Hannibal Lecter was ever on the screen,
played by Brian Cox.
Yeah.
And I picked this film because Michael Mann is always a filmmaker that I've been interested in, and I kind of respect the kind of style that he goes for, but at the same time, I've had a lot of difficulty with connecting with a lot of his films.
Before you recommended these following two films that we're going to discuss, the only Michael Mann films I had seen, Public Enemies.
Oh, man, that
yes,
film is terrible.
I know.
That
I saw that in theaters, and just like, this looked like ass, this story is just, I don't know what I'm watching. Yeah, there was a reason why I did not go to immediately check out the rest of Michael Mann's
discography. But his reputation,
like,
you know, you knew Michael Mann. Like,
I knew
people
Michael
talk
Mann
about
because he was talked about, you know, just
how
like...
How did you miss Collateral?
This guy is the, you know, the shit when it comes to these kind of these action movies with great characters that are kind of, you know, the back and forth is great. There's a lot of great set pieces, just, you know, like especially robbery is like Casey.
Well, you know, you can argue that Michael Mann films are famous for having professional characters who do what they do very well, which is the case of both movies we watched today. And actually, I jumped the gun a little bit because I think I want to talk about Heat first.
You want to talk about Heat?
Yeah, I think that Heat is probably his most... Would you argue that's his most famous film? That when people say Michael Mann, I think that Heat is what pops into their mind.
I think Heat probably is Michael Mann's biggest film. And it's funny because Heat is something that he was trying to do long before he did any of this other stuff.
Well, he did a TV movie version called L.A. Takedown, which I didn't have a chance to watch before we recorded this podcast.
Yeah, but I know that even when they were making Manhunter, he was originally shopping the script to William Peterson for Heat. He was like being like, oh yeah, I'm working on this movie. I think he might be good for a part, whatever. And eventually just went on to make Manhunter. So Heat was something that he was trying to make for years and years and years.
And for anyone who doesn't know Heat, it's the movie that stars Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. And what I like to call it in the review I wrote was character actors are us, because every face that pops up, I know that guy.
Let's talk a little bit about the cast. When I was, because it took, because of the film's running time, it's like a 3-hour film.
It's long.
There were many times that I started the film just like, yeah, I'm going to watch Heat today. And then it was just like, something would come up just like, no, I don't have 3 hours to waste on a film. So I watched the opening credit sequence to Heat at least 5 times.
Really? Like in your life or like in the last week?
In the last week, I watched it at least 5 times. So I got to know that sequence very well. And every single time, just watching the opening credits, it's just an insane list of like character actors or actors that went on to become, you know, like AAA actors. Like who was not in this movie? Like let's just talk about everyone.
John Voight shows up in one of his like, and John Voight is probably like the penultimate character actor that's hit like the mainstream. Well, not really right now because he's in like fighting Karate Dog and stuff like that. But back in the day, he was the man when it came to that stuff.
Oh, he was awesome. But you've also got like early Ashley Judd in this film. You've got you've got, you know, Ted Levine from
Ted Levine being like third guy from the left.
Yeah, and the president from 24, Dennis Haybert, who's got a small but awesome role. Natalie Portman has a small supporting role. You've got freaking Hank Azaria in this movie. You've got Machete. What's his name?
Danny Trejo.
Yeah, Danny Trejo's in this film. Tom Noonan, which we're going to talk about a little bit in Manhunter.
Yeah. It's like a murderer's row. Like, even if you... I could argue that if you don't get that much involved in the story, like you could just wait for the next actor to pop up.
It's an amazing game. Just like guess like who's going to be next. And of course, William Fincher.
But you know what? William Fincher. That's a good. Oh, Henry Rollins as his assistant.
Yeah, Henry Rollins isn't like I was just like, is that Henry Rollins? That is Henry Rollins. Who was not in this movie? It was one of those really type of surreal experiences.
But Michael Mann has always been like that. If you look at the cast of Public Enemies, it's kind of crazy. Channing Tatum shows up for like 10 seconds.
Is he?
Yeah, he plays Pretty Boy Floyd. He's the guy that gets shot at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Like Stephen Dorff.
Like, I haven't watched that film since theaters for obvious reasons.
I held it. I held the Blu-ray in my hands and be like, do I want to pay $5 to revisit this?
It's not worth it. It's not worth it.
Because Michael Mann is someone that, you know, from what I've read about him, he's a guy who loves realism and, like, getting that real feel and having control over what's going on. Specifically, I remember there's a shot in Collateral where they're on a train and he wanted the background to go in, like, a particular direction and to look a particular way, and that was, like, a big deal for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely feels like he had control of the environment. He had control of just, you know, the overall look and feel of the world, because the world that these characters are in, that is definitely a big, you know, major factor of the story. It's just kind of that combination of oppressive and freedom that the characters kind of drift in and out of. Because like, although I have to say that the green screen did not hold
There's
up as well.
There's some really rough green screen in Heat.
When they're looking over like the cityscape. Yeah.
Or they're like in their house and you see outside and you're like, yeah, they're not outside. But, you know, that's a minor quibble in the bigger picture. And you know, speaking of character actors, I mean, I don't think anyone would argue that Robert De Niro and Al Pacino and Val Kilmer are all character actors.
Yeah,
and they always were.
They're character actors, but they became famous for being such good character actors. Mm. So when you throw these guys in like kind of the three main roles of the film, it is very stunning to watch and see what they can do. And I think that's one of Heat's, you know, biggest factors to its success, but it also was a bit of a detriment to me while watching it.
And we were talking about this ties into likability, and it's kind of the reason that I wanted to bring up this big question, is because Heat, you know, it's not just the characters themselves, is that a lot of them have to be thinly sketched very quickly and you get a general idea of them, because it's not too big of a spoiler, but in the first scene, the characters kill a bunch of innocent people in cold blood, and then Michael Mann goes, all right, and you're going to spend 3 hours with these people. And I think that a lot of people have difficulty and they may disconnect from that.
You see, for me watching it, it was just because that opening scene is so great. It's just such a kick in the pants to just be like, oh, like, what the hell is going to happen for this next movie? But one of the big problems for me after watching that scene is that it takes a while before the film to pick, you know, the build up to speed from that awesome opening sequence.
You know, when I first saw Heat, I had the exact same problem you did, but I approached Heat at a when I first got into cinema, and I'm sure I'm going to talk about this a lot when we revisit like classic films, is that I went into Heat going like, John Woo action scenes, like people talk about the big gunfight at the end, and that's what I want to see. Woo! And that's not really why you go see Heat.
Yeah, when you're talking about realism, though, Michael Mann's, I'm wanting to talk about Michael Mann. I've seen three of his films so far. But from what I've noticed out of those films that I've seen is that his idea of realism is a realism that works for me because it's heightened a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, he has his own brand of reality. Of course, characters are not doing backflips.
Specifically in Manhunter.
Yeah, like they're still doing some you know, not quite human things, you know, some things that are not realistic. But at the same time, it works for the drama. It works for the story. It works for the characters. It's there to accentuate. It's not the highlight of the film, I don't think. I believe that the characters are the main thing, and just these high sequences and these action sequences and these gunfight sequences are there to move those characters, to show them like how they respond in those situations.
I think that what's really important too is that in those situations you see those characters become who they've been talking, you know, they've been talking about what they do, and you see them that they're professionals. They know what they're doing and that they react to it in a way that you usually don't expect from action films,
yeah.
Which is like a precise, direct, like we've been doing this for a long time and we know what to do.
Well, that's the big thing with both Manhunter and Heat is that it focuses on characters who are obsessed with their job. Like they can't,
their job is who they are.
They can't escape. Like their job defines them as a person. And it deals a lot with the struggle of just like, okay, when your job is so that huge portion of your life, how does it affect your personal life? And from both those films, not so well, it seems. It seems
no.
that if you're that, you know, if you're the guy that like tracking down criminals is your life, it's going to be a shitty home life. If you're the guy that is like trying to just screw over the law every chance you get, your home life's not going to be that great either.
But, you know, I keep harping on the likable character, but I would argue that other than one particular character who's given his own very minor subplot, all these characters are at their core unlikable because they're all going for things that are difficult to relate to on a moral spectrum. Even Al Pacino, his whole mission is like, I need to stop these people at any cost. And that's all that matters is stopping these people. And he does have that speech where he's like, you want me to take my work? That's an awful Al Pacino. Where he's
what
like,
what the hell? No, let's just stop for a moment. You can't just sweep that under the rug and be like, let's just move on.
That was my actor voice.
No, what Pacino movie? What Pacino movie? Is that
that was Scent of a Woman? Oh, hoo-ah! That's what I was going for. But yeah, Al Pacino has that speech where he goes, I'm completely red faced now. He goes, you know, I don't want to bring home the work that I have to do. Like, it's horrible. You know, brain splattered everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, you know, you can relate to him. But the lengths that he goes at the end, it's not about, you know, doing the right thing anymore. It's about stopping them.
No, that I'm pretty sure a scene that people talk about, aside from the bank heist scene, is probably the diner conversation between
Al Pacino and Robert De Niro.
Yeah, that scene is so wonderful, and apparently it like the story that this is loosely based on, like that actually happened. Like the guy that was hunting down the criminal, they actually did get together in a coffee shop and just talk about, just like, hey, I know you're up to something, I'm going to be hunting you down. Like let's at least talk about this since we are such huge part like of each other's lives right now. And that scene really does sum it up. And I talked to you a little bit after I watched this that I was a little bit kind of frustrated with, because I had already seen so many of the beats of Heat because Christopher Nolan ripped them off wholesale
for Dark Knight.
It's just like, I heard that it was a reference to Heat and that it Lovely alluded to it, but I thought that was just from the opening like high sequence because like once again William Fincher is also in that too.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that, you know, basically the exact same plot and themes were going to be present throughout the entire film.
And I like the fact that, you know, Al Pacino opens fires on bank robbers. Like he opens fire on bank robbers. And that is such like a disconnect for me because it's money. And Robert De Niro states when he's robbing the bank that this is insured. It doesn't matter. No one is losing actual money.
I would argue throughout the film that De Niro is actually the more likable character out of the two. I found myself rooting for him a little bit more because his whole thing with life was, even though he does some, you know, deplorable things, his big thing, his motivation is you know, to find happiness and to have, you know, his personal life and to build a relationship and to get away and support, you know, his crew, which is basically his family. And, but at the same time, you know, Pacino's whole objective is just like, I've got to stop these people. His whole obsession is with his job. And just for the sake of, you know, stopping them, while De Niro, of course, he is obsessed with his job. But at the same time, his job seems like it's towards trying to build a life for himself.
You kind of get that sense in the end of the film, but at the beginning, you, with a lot of these films that center around criminals, sometimes you have the issue of, like, why are they doing these things? You know, you keep doing crime and crime and crime, and when does it become just a job, like you said? And when are you using that job to go into something else? And, you know, Robert De Niro, at first, you feel like he's just doing the job. And, you know, he doesn't want to kill people, but he will not hesitate if he has to.
Yeah, because he's a professional. Once again, like, these characters are professionals. They know what it takes to get in and out of situations, and they're willing to do those things.
And there's even that line where he says, you know, one person is dead. It's the same rap that if you kill three other people. So at that point, it's not even a moral question. It's just a question of logistics for them, which is like, you know, none of these characters are likable. And I am sure you read it online, but Al Pacino supposedly in the first draft that he was supposed to be a coke addict, and that's why he's acting so crazily.
I thought that was just Pacino being Pacino.
Yeah. He's like a big fat ass at one point.
Yeah, and once again, that's a little bit why the film, just like, even though Pacino, like, I'm not particularly rooting for him, I'm still curious to see, like, what's Pacino going to pull?
So crazy.
Yeah, what's he going to pull out of his ass for this scene? Like, what's he going
to
do?
You know, not to get into spoilers at the end, but who would you have wanted to see get out at the end? When it's definitely a face-off between the both characters.
I'm just going to say that the last act of the film, like around the last 45 minutes or so, I found myself rooting for De Niro. I found myself in De Niro's corner.
Even though he shot in a crowded place, you know, probably injuring a bunch of people. That was, you know, I didn't notice, but there wasn't that many close-ups of innocent bystanders being shot in the climax, was there?
No, there wasn't that really. It's the scene is handled very well, where it's basically just see people running and jumping out of the way. I'm pretty sure a few get caught in the crossfire, but most, it literally is just this intense showdown between these two opposing
forces.
Think
the film, you would have interpreted it differently if there were innocent bystanders being in the crossfire, especially from De Niro's crew? Because, you know, the innocent people that died at the beginning, they were doing a job, and, you know, technically they knew the risks that were involved in this job.
Yeah, I'm going to say that the choice not to show the civilians was definitely an obvious one from Michael Mann, because I do feel at that point in the film, he makes it an issue to kind of just be like, oh yeah, at the beginning of the film, like, you know, these are
you're
just the bad guys.
The stakes,
yeah, these are just the bad guys. These are the stakes. But as it goes on, like, those characters, they're the ones that have more challenges that are thrown at them. They're the ones that have to work their way through things. So whether, you know, the question of morality is out, but I do find myself being like, I care about more what happens and seeing what happens to these characters than I do with Pacino.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how would you, like, put the film as far as, like, crime films go?
I don't really know. Like, I enjoyed it, but
I didn't love it.
I didn't love it. It wasn't a film where immediately after I watched it, I'm just like, yeah, goddamn, like, Heat, man.
Do,
like,
you think that's because it's been, like, absorbed a lot in pop culture? Like, I don't know when this film came and what was around it, but this kind of, like, you know, it's a tapestry. That's what it's painting. Like, there's a lot of characters. Like, we haven't even talked about, like, Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
Or
well, it's a huge ensemble piece, and I give, you know, a giant bravo for being able to handle all those characters and still have everyone feel distinct, still have everyone feel unique, and not just this gigantic blur of just, like, who the hell is this? Like,
or
what's going on?
You know, the third act being basically an epilogue after the big thing happened, and how all of those pieces start to play off against each other and reach a conclusion, basically the only conclusion these kind of movies can reach.
Yeah. So I do think it's a great movie, but it's not a movie that I walked out of being like, yeah, I really love Michael Mann.
What about Manhunter?
See, Manhunter is a film that I originally was interested in, not because of Michael Mann. It was a film when I was researching a lot of cinematography.
The cinematographer.
Yes. Sorry that I cut you off there, Justin. But no, there was a cinematographer by the name of Dante Spinotti.
What else has he done?
He was one of those guys that Well, my big influence, why I wanted to see his work, because he shot L.A. Confidential, which is absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous movie.
Classic neo-noir.
Yeah, he was one of those Europe directors of photography that actually, Manhunter was his first kind of U.S. film that they brought him in to do, because just like, yeah, here's this guy, Michael Mann. Like, he's done Thief, he's done like a really great TV movie or whatever. Just like, see if he'll get along with him. So I was approaching Manhunter actually from the cinematography standpoint, and that's why I was interested in it, not because of the Michael Mann. Like, I had forgotten that this was a Hannibal Lecter film. I had forgotten all those factors that came into it. So I was just approaching this for the cinematography and for the fact that it's supposed to be a good film. What made you want to watch Manhunter?
Probably Michael Mann. It was a film that I remember when I first got into movies had a million DVD releases. Anchor Bay put out like a 2-disc edition, a single edition, a new 2-disc edition.
Well, that's Anchor Bay, man. That's yeah. Their bread and butter.
I need a new version of Army of Darkness. So I wanted to, and I remember watching it and it not doing that much for me. I remember renting it from Rogers, but that was a long time ago. And I think that I go in with a different, you know, set of expectations now. So I, when I sat down and watched it, I cleared my mind. And weirdly, I watched Silence of the Lambs like 2 weeks ago.
How was that jumping from Silence of the Lambs back to this? Because aren't there still overlapping characters aside from Lecter?
Yeah, there are. But I think that Manhunter, and you were talking about the cinematographer, Manhunter seems to live in its own universe. I don't think that while, you know, some of the emotions and drama you can link, you know, it's obviously relatable. I think that visually, it's completely disconnected from anything. And I think that you can't even compare it to Silence of the Lambs. Even, like, the Hannibal Lecter character is completely different.
No, you can't. I actually have to say that, you know, I do love Anthony Hopkins' version of Hannibal Lecter, but I love the kind of just how Brian Cox's interpretation keeps a lot of it more under the surface, that you kind of just look at him and you feel kind of this stuff, you know, brewing inside of him.
You never get to see Hannibal Lecter do anything really atrocious in Red Dragon.
No, he is
Manhunter.
He is very much just a supporting character. He's there to move the plot forward. He
Which
is not the...
weird, because it was never a movie before that featured that. I'm not really familiar with Thomas Harris's chronology of these stories, and I mean, the fact that they've gone back to Silence of the Lambs and Red Dragon makes me think that there probably isn't like a defining Hannibal Lecter
story. There was one other movie made from the one of the author's works previous, but I can't recall the name of it. But this was not the first book that was adapted from his works.
But it was
the first Hannibal Lecter film that was taken from those series of novels.
And I think that, you know, I forget his full name, but I think the cast is really helped by William Peterson's. Is it William Peterson's superior, played by a real life cop who actually passed away just a little while ago. He was in Snatch. He had one of the main characters.
Yeah, I know. Like, I wanted to check his name because just like that guy was great. Is it Dennis Farina?
Yeah, Dennis Farina. Yeah, and yeah. He's great in that movie.
Oh, he is so great into it. Just like I love the intro to that film where he just comes up to him on the beach and just like, hey, I got a job for you. There's something about that is just so essentially like film noir, and just it throws you right into that world of a character struggling between the darkness and the light, that just like I was kind of sold from the first 5 minutes of this movie.
But I think that's something that you could pursue this negatively or positively, is that the characters in this barely feel like characters. They're sketches. They feel like action figures that Michael Mann is placing very specifically in these situations, and specifically these frames.
I think it works, though, for the character of Will Graham from William Peterson, who, believe it or not, when watching it, I had no idea that he was the same guy from CSI, because just like the curly hair, it completely threw me off. So I was just like, I wasn't even thinking, just like, holy shit, this is the guy that went on the star in CSI.
You know what? I'm going to jump on the negative train here, but I thought he was pretty wooden in this film. I had a little bit, I could connect with him on what he was doing and like the struggle that he was going to, but it didn't really have an emotional rise in me. And not to say that he's not a good actor, because he's great in To Live and Die in L.A., the William Friedkin film,
yeah,
who he has the main role in that. Like, he's unhinged in that film, while in this role where he had to play something that was a little bit like more buttoned down because of his character. And even the times where he does kind of freak out, where he's like, you fucking killed her! You killed her, you bastard! It just felt like it rang like a little bit of a false note in me.
See, I didn't mind his performance. I don't think it's a particularly strong one. I think that he is more just there to... This film is definitely, the visuals are the key force in moving the story and moving the drama forward. But I do think that his character you're talking about, just there not being much to the character. I think it works for his character, though, because of the fact that
he's supposed to be a blank slate.
And also that he has become so defined, and like his whole thing is that he's trying to become a character throughout the film, is that he starts out as this guy, and you do see a little bit of his character in his family life, but then he has to strip all that away and try to become a madman, to try to become a serial killer, to try to put himself in this mindset where he can predict what the killer is going to do next. He can figure out his motivation and his actions. So I think in that way, having him be not so much, you know, this vibrant personality or necessarily even that interesting
charismatic,
one. Yeah, charismatic. It works for him because of the fact that I felt that he was beginning to embody this certain character.
So by at the end of the line where they ask him, like, who are you, when he says his name?
Yeah, yeah, I love that little moment.
That's a great payoff.
That is a huge great payoff. It's not like necessarily a big one. Like, it can be one that can fly completely past you, but since so much of the film, it's him, you know, struggling with defining who he is. And it has that nice little scene where they're in the grocery store with his son.
Yeah.
Just like,
I think those scenes work, and I think that may be more of like the kid's performance or the wife's performance, and that he's more of a mirror reflecting what they're feeling more than like he's emoting.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. I personally love that choice because of the fact that he is a character who's lost. He has no identity because he is struggling so much with determining his own that he doesn't really become himself until the end, when just like he's just like, Will Graham.
Yeah. What I mean, like, it's funny because Will Graham is starring in a TV show, the Hannibal TV show. Like, the main character is that character.
Oh, I haven't even seen the Hannibal TV
show. No, I haven't either. So it'd be interesting to see how the character is interpreted by the actor that plays him. If you know, go on the Laser Blast Film Society forum and write. I didn't mention it before, but before we get back into Manhunter, if you have an opinion about the big question, do care, how important is it for characters to be likable? Write examples.
Yeah, we love hearing from you guys and what your thoughts and your viewpoints are on all this stuff.
Especially someone like Chris Nash mentioned that Troy Duffy is supposedly a very nice guy when he met him in real life.
Yeah, it's always much more interesting to hear, both sides of the story, so to speak. But we're just here to facilitate the conversation for the time being. But yes, back to Manhunter.
Like you, we touched on it, but visuals is what this film lives and breathes on.
Yes.
The visuals propel the story, and the visuals propel the action, specifically because this is a film that's mostly made up of stillness.
Yeah.
And even when the film does jump to life, it's like a herky-jerky, like it doesn't really know what to do with it. And what I'm speaking is the big act of violence that happens in the last, 10 minutes.
I love the finale. I absolutely love the finale. When they were making it, actually, they were running out of money, and so like the crew was abandoning the set. So a lot of that stuff was shot without any special effects guys on set. It was just like do-it-yourself filmmaking 101 madness, where like Michael Mann was just like smashing shit and just
breaking
glass.
But you didn't feel
there was
like a jump cut in that scene where someone gets shot, and that kind of pulled me out of it because you're getting stylistic sex
of
a music
video. I like the fact that because of the film, it has such a heavy dread, and this is one thing in the film that I experienced more than watching Heat. Heat, there were times just like, why am I still watching this? It was just like, I found it to be interesting, but I was just like, I did not feel compelled to keep going with the story. Manhunter, because it does have that ticking clock sort of scenario with it, and because just like I was so interested in seeing how he would piece together the pieces or just revealing more information about the Tooth Fairy killer, all those elements, they come into play. So I was much more, on the edge of my seat throughout Manhunter than I was with Heat. He was just like, oh, here's a cool scene. Just like, oh yeah, some nice character back and forth.
But even though Manhunter kind of drops the main character a little bit more than two thirds of the way through to focus on the killer, played by the incomparable Tom Noonan, villain in Last Action Hero.
Yeah. Well, let's talk for a second about Tom Noonan. Oh, bad guy, RoboCop 2.
Yes, that's
not
right.
Not really the greatest role, but still one that popped. But also Frankenstein, Monster Squad.
Yes, he's great in Frankenstein. Supposedly crazy guy extraordinaire.
Yes, he is very much a character actor. He wouldn't let his victims see him when they were filming the scenes of the killer. So he got super into the role. So he would basically just like, yeah, it's kind of like that crazy character actor stuff that you hear about. But it worked because damn, is he creepy in this film. He is just completely unsettling. That first reveal shot when you get of him, when he's got the hose over his eyes and his nose, like, oh man.
Especially a film that doesn't really revel in the violence. It's all implied, and that the dread comes from just Tom Noonan's performance and what people talk about, because like, Man, if you think of like a creepy, scary serial killer, especially, you know, they do the important thing of they do make him kind of likable. And like they give him human. Okay, likable is a big stretch.
Yeah, that's
they give
a very
him
big
human.
Stretch.
They give him human characteristics, and they take that time to, you know, like, let's give a quick love story here that takes place over one night.
But that all ties into the character's motivation. The reason that's what William Peterson's character kind of discovers is the fact that he's a character searching to be, you know, to want it, to feel that, and he feels that through his acts of killing that he's becoming wanted.
Yeah,
by
yeah.
Doing
Tom Noonan is becoming something else than he is. I mean, they're both searching.
Yeah.
For that one thing.
Yeah, but oh man, just what he does. Like I absolutely loved his performance in this, and just there was a stillness, but also just like that kind of craziness, just reaching out from, you know, just beneath the surface. I found it to be very compelling. I found it to be very frightening. But yeah, I think the biggest scene still for me is that scene where he first captures the reporter and mm-hmm.
he's wearing himself. Like pantyhose on
yeah
the...
just the performance in that and everything about that is just like got underneath my skin and just like kind of just like creeped me out a bit.
I think that it's impossible to talk about Manhunter without talking about its other adaptation, which I mentioned very briefly, Brett Ratner's Red Dragon, which the same cinematographer worked on? That's so crazy.
Yeah, man, I don't know. It's so weird because I haven't seen all of Red Dragon. I've only, you know, like seen the trailer or some scenes from it. But
Blandtown.
Yeah, and I guess it is because of the fact that by that point, you know, Anthony Hopkins, this was, what, that's the third time that he's played the character?
Yeah,
because
he Hannibal, Silence of the Lambs, yeah, Red Dragon.
Yeah, so it's, I haven't seen it, so I can't comment on it too much, but. And Brett Ratner kind of just sums up for me. Yeah.
Which makes me sad because Brett Ratner is directing the Hercules movie starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Yeah, we'll see if his charisma can save that or not.
So, Manhunter, recommendation. Heat, recommendation from me. Tepid recommendation from Pierce.
Yeah.
Good,
no,
not great.
No, Heat. I would still recommend the people.
Yes.
I think that it's a great film, but it's not a film that I loved by any
stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, it was just it was there. I can see the influence that it had, and maybe back in the future, I can see being one of those films where like, hey, you know, it's a Sunday afternoon. I'm just going to put this on while I like do some other stuff and like get really into those scenes that pop to me. You know, like those scenes with Pacino and De Niro and all those.
Did you just use the expression "back to the future"?
Did I?
Yeah, you went back to the future.
I don't even know what I said. I'm gonna have to.
Well, speaking of great movies and movies that we're going to recommend, it's time to get to the recommendations part of the show. I'm going to recommend a film that recently came onto iTunes and other distribution platforms, which is one that you really didn't hear talk about unless you were looking for it. And that is Grand Piano, starring Elijah Wood. The only real place I heard it talked about was from Fantastic Fest, specifically BadassDigest.com, which is owned by the Alamo, so that's mm-hmm. why they would talk about it. But Grand Piano is a very small film, but I think this will probably excite Pierce. It is a straight-up Hitchcock Brian De Palma homage. Like, that's all it is. The characters are very thinly sketched. You barely get any background, and you get into the situation where Elijah Wood is a piano player who's doing a big concert, and if he hits one wrong note, a sniper will shoot him, played by John Cusack.
I heard of this, and I thought this was still coming out late in the year. I didn't know that it was just released.
It got dumped right to video.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because this is one that I heard. I saw some, you know, previews for it and just, like, news stories. You're like, what the hell is this movie? This sounds kind of great, but also it sounds like it's one of those movies where if it doesn't quite work, it's just going to fail so miserably because it's like that with all concept films, I find.
It's a lot of fun, and the director has, you know, I don't think it has the dramatic impact that something like this can, but it's kind of like minor Hitchcock. But it's, you know, when you have something like Hitchcock or Brian De Palma is basically like Hitchcock, all the best bits.
Yeah.
And that's what Grand Piano is, where like there's this crazy camera move, which is a little shaky because they use green screen, but where like a guy goes up the stairs, across the balcony, and then goes to a side hallway where he talks to another person, and then the side hallway is on one side of the screen, and you can see the amphitheater and Elijah Wood playing the piano on the other, and you know it looks like one shot, but then suddenly something starts to happen and the camera starts zooming in on Elijah Wood while the other side of the screen stays static. It's like those kind of gags that play out.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic.
Also, Alex Winter is one of the villains in the movie. Okay. Going back to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, wow, man. Yeah, that guy's got to look different now. But, yeah, my choice for this week is a little bit of an older film. Like I said before, I'm going back and checking out some of the library classics. And one out of all the films that I watched this week, the one that had the strongest impact on me was Akira Kurosawa's 1963 High and Low.
Yeah, I did not steal that name for our High and Low segment, but it is, in fact, a great movie, a classic. I don't think anyone can argue that movie's not good unless you hate puppies.
Yeah. I have to agree with that. But man, cinematography in this film, absolutely gorgeous. It has one of my favorite shots out of any sort of recent memory. There's a scene where a kidnapper is like peering through like bushes at night in the moonlight. He's wearing these sunglasses, and there's just something about that shot. It's towards the end of the film, but it's one of the most gorgeous things I think I've ever seen in black and white. It is just so damn beautiful.
And it's also, like Heat, I think it's about a three-hour-long film.
Yeah, it's a three-hour film, but the difference between this and Heat is with High and Low, I was never checking my watch and being like, oh, like, how far are we into this movie? It is very much a procedural type of drama where it does also focus on, it shifts gears halfway and it goes into the police perspective where it's people are just so obsessed with, like, their job and, like, getting it done.
For people that don't know what High and Low is, it's a story about a very rich businessman played by Mifune. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say his first name because I'm going to get it wrong.
Yeah, that's why I'm avoiding pronouncing half of these names.
He plays a really rich businessman who, on the day of a big business deal, kidnap his son. Or we learn later on the kidnappers didn't kidnap his son. They kidnapped his driver's son. So yes. Mifune has to make a decision. Is he going to pay out this ransom to save the life of a boy that he doesn't know and in the process bankrupting him? Or does he just, you know, wash his hands of it and go, it's not my problem? What did you like better? Did you like the moral dilemma at the first hour and a half, which basically plays out like a chamber drama? Mm-hmm. Or did you like the procedural of the second half?
I like them both, but the problem is that I do get a little bit bored with chamber dramas. I have a feeling, personally, like, those have to be really, really strong chamber dramas in order to keep me interested as an audience, but staying in one location for so long. It's really interesting, though, how they did that, because I felt that it was a perfect way to go from that character's isolation in his world into jumping out into, you know, just how terrible the world that surrounds him actually is, and just how dark and seedy it can be, how destructive it can be. But I really, really love the second half where it turns into the police
Law and Order half.
Yeah, when they're trying to track this guy down, because all the stuff they're doing, I never found to be boring. I was always very, very interested in just like, how are they going to put these pieces together? How are they going to get the next lead? How are they going to do this? How are they going to do that? And then the last 20 minutes or so of this movie.
Oh, well, that final confrontation at the end.
Yeah, you know, that is
classic. That's classic cinema. Like, yeah, there's no doubt.
That is one of the best, you know, face-to-face kind of conversations that I've seen. And it did remind me, like, out of all the scenes that I feel like, I even feel, you know, that there were bits in that scene of Heat that were reminiscent from that confrontation. Because if you're going to do a confrontation where you have two guys where so much of the movie is them kind of building up to a point, that's the way you do it. It is just perfect.
So our two recommendations of the week are Akira Kurosawa's High and Low and the Elijah Wood starring Grand Piano. You've been listening to the Laser Blast Film Society. My name's Justin DeClue.
I'm Pierce Dirks.
Dunka, 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 Chino!
And boom, there you have it. It's actually 32 seconds, so I got to lose 2 seconds. Maybe you can tell me what part you would lose, but I think we are getting there.
Burn this.
I'm sorry?
This must never be seen.